Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
What are these guys?
They're called ghost peppers.
No, go ahead, open them. I had to order them special over the internet from a place called the Ghost Pepper Store.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah.
I think I got it.
So what do you know about these things?
I know that they're crazy hot, and I know I'm never going to finish one.
So I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm here with...
Ezra Spitzer.
You're listening to Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX. And what do you think this is going to be like?
It's going to be the hottest thing I've ever tried.
Do you think it's going to be fun?
Maybe. I mean, it could be fun. It could be crazy.
I'm kind of scared.
You're kind of scared?
Yeah.
I'm a little scared that you're going to basically, we're going to put on the radio the sound of a 9-year-old being tortured. It's just going to sound like pain. And people are going to think that I'm a monster.
You're not a monster. And this, we're doing this for a week that is all about ghosts, so... I think it deserves to hear me screaming.
There you go. It's okay to be scared this week because the theme on Sound Effect this week is ghosts. Ezra is about to eat this ghost pepper. What are our other supplies here?
Well, we've got a big glass of milk, even though I don't really like milk, but when I'm trying hot peppers, I'm willing to have a ton of milk.
And what else?
And we've got some ice cream.
Okay, whenever you're ready.
It's not so bad.
So you just took a tiny bite?
I just took a really tiny bite. Oh my god. It comes in later. Oh, it's so hot. Oh my god. Something because I'm at drooling. Ice cream, wait, gimme. I'm turning into a ghost here. Please help me.
Some people just aren't afraid of ghosts. We're gonna have unusual ghost stories, none of which involve actual ghosts, coming up here on Sound Effect from 88.5 on KKX. Don't go away. Should I try a little tiny piece? Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, whoa. Oh, no. I don't know, man. Ugh, here, give me some of that milk.
Yeah.
Come on, come on, dude. Come on, give me. Not funny, not cool. So we have a ghost story to tell you, but not the spooky kind. This one involves tsunamis, chainsaws, samurai, and trees. This is the story of a ghost forest. So picture a verdant green Pacific Northwest forest, and right there in the middle of it is this stand of gray-white dead trees. There's no obvious reason they're dead, they just stand there, hauntingly. A couple of scientists had this hunch that the ghost forest held a secret, and the secret affects you and me and anyone else who's concerned about our region crumbling in a major earthquake. To unlock it, they would need to find out what killed the trees and, crucially, the time of death. Instead of DNA or carpet fibers or whatever those CSI people use, David Yamaguchi uses tree rings. You might remember that rings can reveal a tree's age and sometimes help pinpoint when the tree died. Well, Yamaguchi agreed to show me the ghost forest, which can be accessed by a quick paddle up the Copalis River on the Washington coast.
Basically, the trees, well, they're dead, and it's kind of mysterious why they're dead, right? They're not obviously charred by fire, and they're out here on the, near the ocean, And so they're basically, you know, our local version of Trees of Mystery. Why are they dead?
What look like sort of scraggly, skeletal, giant sticks poking out of the ground. Trees with no branches, basically.
Yes, and more than being sticks, they're full-size trees.
Yamaguchi and geologist Brian Atwater knew that there had been tsunamis here before, so they wanted to know whether the trees died around the same time as the last major wave. For that, they needed rings.
The approach is to collect a sample from these trees that I could take home and study in a laboratory, and so I resorted to using a chainsaw and cutting rectangular holes out of the trunks.
So again, what you're doing is you're reading the pattern of the tree rings, and then you're going to match them to a tree that you know very well, how old it is and what years those rings correspond to, and that'll tell you when this thing died?
Exactly right.
So is this the kind of thing you can demo?
Okay, sure.
For Yamaguchi, this story started 30 years ago when, just out of college, he was working at Mount St. Helens, and one day Atwater visited, bringing some intriguing findings.
Presenting the first field evidence that the entire Pacific Northwest had had major earthquakes in the past.
Because we knew at that time that they had big quakes here, but not big quakes.
Right, exactly right. The big questions were, do big earthquakes happen? When, how often, what magnitude, and then, of course, the last one is when is the next one?
Yamaguchi decided to sign on with Atwater's quest. And they had a few scattered hints. Soil layers seemed to show that the land had actually dropped in a big quake centuries ago. And there was another clue around Nea Bay where the Macaw people have an old legend.
And so Brian drove out to the coast and started looking at Nea Bay, which was a place that there is this native legend of the sea flowing inland and forcing the macaw to jump in their canoes and to ride through these great waves. At that point, Brian knew very little about the coast. He had only been to Nea Bay and the Neawaikum River in Willapa Bay. He began to explore, and one of the rivers he explored was the Copalis River here, where there is a Copalis ghost forest. What makes sense is that the forest was lowered into the sea. These cedars, which are intolerant of brackish water, were lowered into brackish water, and the brackish water killed them. And so the above-ground trunks have been preserved, and I need intact trunks. And so he called me on the phone and said, David, you've got to come back and take a look at this cedar forest out here. And when I came back, I thought, oh, this might just work.
The clues seemed to point toward an earthquake and tsunami as the culprits. But what they didn't realize was that their mystery wasn't the only one. There was another riddle to be solved all the way across the Pacific Ocean.
So the first initial discovery, which I only published as an abstract, was the trees in the Copalis ghost forest, as well as in similar forests nearby, died sometime in the 1670s, 80s, and simultaneously radiocarbon dates told us the same thing. And we just kind of forgot about it, and we went on with other projects. And a few years later, Kenji Satake in Japan heard that we had this approximate date window for potentially a large earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. First of all, by training, Kenji Satake is a tsunami modeler. And so what he does is generate an earthquake of some magnitude, for example, like 7, 8, or 9 on the Pacific Northwest coast. And then he could
run on a computer.
Right, on a computer screen. And he began to realize, that if you have 8s or 9s, they should cross the Pacific and strike the Japanese coast. But the second thing that he knew was 1700 is a long time ago in terms of American history. But in Japanese history, it's nothing. Literacy arrived in Japan, I think, about the time of Buddhism in the 5th century, and then from that time, written records proliferate across the country. As a tsunami researcher, he knew that if we had had a magnitude 8 or 9 earthquake right around 1700, that it should have crossed the ocean and hit Japan. So he just opened up the right volume and literally popped out at him that, you know, up and down about 600 miles of Japanese coast were a series of villages that each reported being struck by waves. Probably most of us growing up have seen samurai movies here and there, and this was the exact time period where there are a lot of little kingdoms fighting one another, and at some point one big kahuna takes over the country. And so once he unifies the country, first of all, he has to collect taxes. So there's all these administrative records that are kept on anything that affects the rice harvest.
So if it affected the rice harvest, it was record worthy.
Right. And so in one village, the tsunami ran into the local rice warehouse. Oh, so we cannot fully pay our taxes. In another community, you know, X number of houses were destroyed by the waves. And so they were making an appeal for wood from the government. My favorite one is of a village headman. This particular case was unusual. He writes, "I have heard that if you have an earthquake, then a tsunami is something that follows. But in this case, in the vicinity of our village, we felt no earthquake."
That detail was big. If there was no local earthquake to generate the Japanese tsunami, then maybe it was caused by a superquake way over here by Washington. The trick is that the dates needed to match as exactly as possible. So the mystery wasn't solved.
Not yet. It was an intriguing argument. And so Brian asked me, "Do you think you could match the rings in those roots below the ground, maybe 6 feet under the ground, with your rings of your trunks?" I don't think it had been done before, but we thought it was a worthwhile shot. And all but one, the outermost ring was the calendar year 1699. And so those trees were growing just fine. And then that 1700 summer, the trees were all dead.
The picture that emerged was of a wave ripping across the Pacific at about the speed of a jet airplane. Working backwards, the scientists were able to pinpoint when the quake likely happened with a freaky degree of precision. January 26th, 1700, at 9 p.m. in the darkness of a northwest winter night.
The big question that we were grappling with here that we just couldn't resolve in North America was, are we looking at a magnitude 8 event or a magnitude 9 event? Would the matching of the tree ring records here with the tsunami records in Japan, that was the first time at which magnitude 9 began to look very real. And from an engineering perspective, that really matters a lot. Engineers need to know specific numbers to build buildings by, where to put tsunami escape markers and road signs.
So what did that feel like for you to be getting what seems like the last pieces of the puzzle?
So for all scientists, I think we all strive to discover something that matters. And for most people, what you actually end up doing is just making incremental findings that specialists in your field care about, but nobody else cares. And through the quirks of fate, I had managed to make this discovery that is of significance to people who live in the Pacific Northwest.
When you go back to the ghost forest now, what feeling do you get as you walk among those ghostly trees?
To me, it's just sort of the same majesty of the forest that I appreciated as a high school student. That, you know, we could be living here as residents of the Pacific Northwest and within a few hours' drive of home, walk among these giants from the past.
Dr. David Yamaguchi is a dendrochronologist, a tree ring expert in Seattle. Welcome back to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is ghosts. Losing someone you love is, of course, devastating, and sometimes you can't shake the feeling that they're somehow still there. Michelle Goodman lives in Shoreline. Her husband, Greg, died last year from cancer. He was 47. Today, Michelle is figuring out how to move forward with Greg's ghost still lingering in her life. She wrote about this in-between place for the Washington Post. In this next piece, Michelle reads excerpts from that essay and talks with her sister, Naomi Goodman, who has been with her on this entire journey.
I had to remind myself that he wouldn't be walking through the front door to make dinner with me and take the dog to the nearby park afterward. I had to remind myself because grief is sneaky. It fools you into thinking the impossible is possible so you don't die of shock. I was kind of being a weirdo, and I was like, well, maybe we could just weekend at Bernie's him. I mean, we could kind of just arrange him in a bunch of funny positions and, you know, take some photos or cart him around town to his places he liked. And
he's really big. It would have been really hard.
It would have been hard to do.
We wouldn't have been able to do it.
My sister led the funeral home people downstairs to the man cave where Greg had chosen to ride out his last couple weeks as a living, breathing husband. She didn't want me to watch them zip Greg into the black bag and wheel him away.
These folks show up at the house and they were really small people. And I'm looking at them like, there is no way in hell you're going to be able to take this enormous human out of the house. And they are in this room with him for, I don't even know, it felt like eternity, just like strategizing on like how to get him, I think, from the bed to the gurney to the whatever. And I'm like sort of peeking in, but I don't really want to look, but I'm waiting, like, are they going to drop him? Am I going to hear something? Do I have to go help? And it just was like endless, just, you know, that tape in your head of, oh my God, what the hell are these people doing? And they finally got him out and, you know, I saw them wheel him out to the street into the vehicle and like, it's terrible, right? It's your brother and he's like in a friggin' plastic bag.
Suffice it to say that today my sister has no doubt that Greg is dead. But I do. I'm not religious. I have no idea what happens when we die, but when someone close to me says, when Greg died, it's as if I know something they don't. You see someone that has the same frame and hair as the person you lost, and just for a brief moment, even though it's been almost a year, is that, oh, that can't be him, but that happens, and that's crazy. You know, like, when I was doing dishes, he would come up behind me and put his arms around me, which I found annoying at the time, even though it's so sweet. I think about that every time I'm doing the dishes, and I can sort of imagine him being behind me, and sometimes I do think he's there, just in a way. He's just a part of like this life that we built, so in some ways he's just still there. The first 3 or 4 months Greg was gone, I felt as though he were just on a long vacation. I'm still married, I just haven't seen him in a few months, I told a couple friends. But the more times I had to check the widowed box in some form or another, the more permanent Greg's vacation seemed.
And if the box could say something different, what would it say?
I don't know what I wish it would say. It's complicated. Or I'm single, but there's this person in my life. They're just not here anymore. I like it's complicated.
Right after Greg died, they kept having all of these experiences in the house.
I asked Greg to haunt me. I said, please come visit me. And he said, well, I'll do what I can. Because who knows, right?
The light over his desk kept blinking and you couldn't get it off for days, right? And then the dogs kept going potty by his desk. What is going on in this house?
One dog came over and just sat and looked at Greg's desk chair and barked at it all evening.
What haunts you about the day that Greg died?
I just hoped it was not terrible. You know, I hoped he was in his morphine sleep happy haze and he had no idea what happened. And I hope, you know, he kind of suffered a lot. Everyone knows about cancer. Everyone knows that people die all the time and die young, and kids, and, you know, it's horrible. And but and you know what's coming, and you know what the doctor said, even though you didn't think it was going to be as fast as it was, or you hope these like long shot cures might work, but nothing prepares you for the actual real event of the person's not breathing anymore, and they're just not going to be physically in your life anymore.
And I think that's hard for us because we are wired fixers to fix things and to solve problems. So I think that's probably where a lot of the denial maybe is helpful, because you can't fix this.
Michelle Goodman and her sister Naomi Goodman live in the Seattle area. To hear Michelle read the entire essay she wrote for the Washington Post, you can go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme this week is ghosts. And right now I'm sitting in the theater at the Langston Hughes Performing Arts Center with Rachel Kessler, who's a Seattle writer. Want to say hi?
Hello.
And it'll become clear in a few moments why we're here. But we're going to begin by asking Rachel to read part of an essay that she wrote that was recently anthologized in this book, Ghosts of Seattle Past.
So this is the part somewhere in the middle, and it's entitled Herman Kessler. I ride down Yesler every day to get to the library, where I research and write. At this point, I decide to investigate my own family's history, which, it turns out, is connected to Yesler Way and 17th, the next point on this tour of this essay. How far back do you know your family? The genealogy librarian opened up the ancestry search engine on the computer in front of us. I knew I had a great-great-grandfather named Herman Kessler. My dad told me that he was a Klondiker and Jewish. I had never paid much attention to these old stories. Several articles in the Seattle Times popped up. The librarian opened the most recent, an obituary. A large black-and-white photo of a robust older man with round spectacles and a trim Van Dyke beard, whose deep-set eyes and full lips pressed together in a smirk called to mind my quick-talking uncle, my dad's older brother. Although my uncle is much more fun than this silver-haired gentleman appeared. His gaze penetrated through the photo-emulsion process, the intervening 70 years, the low-resolution newspaper scan, and accused me. Where had I been? Why had I not paid attention? His face was not handsome, puffy, yet dignified. Heart attack takes Herman Kessler at 77. The librarian read the obituary out loud as I scanned ahead, my heart rate accelerating into a gallop as Herman's life opened up before us. Herman Kessler, a leader in Seattle's Orthodox Jewish community, died of a heart attack yesterday afternoon in his apartment, 2014 Yesler Way. Mr. Kessler was born in Austria and came to Seattle in 1889 in a sailing vessel. He was president of the Congregation Booker. He was also president of Seattle Talmud Torah Hebrew School. Honorary pallbearers will include Mayor Earl Milliken, superior judges. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock Sunday in Bicker Kolim Synagogue, 17th Avenue and Yesler Way. Your Herman was a big man, said the librarian. Yesler Way, that's my neighborhood, I said. The next day on my ride downtown, I investigated the apartment address from the obit. There it was, on the north side of the street, a three-story, block-wide, early 1900s apartment building, painted peach with orange accents, across the street from a coffee shop I frequented in Pratt Park. Every day I rode right past the place where my great-great-grandpa died alone on his birthday. The address of the old synagogue is right where the Langston Hughes Performing Arts Institute stands. I locked my bike to a stop sign and climbed the stairs to the formal western entrance. The grand building's former life as a synagogue now became apparent in its architectural details. Classical lines, Palladian arched windows, and a shallow dome above the square center. This is how bricks and stone say temple. Immediately right of the three sets of doors, a large polished granite rectangle amidst the smaller cream-colored brick facade caught my eye. I scooted around behind a trash can and saw text engraved on it. Cornerstone, laid, May 1915, Hermann Kessler. High as muckamuck, for sure. Without knowing it, I had been riding my bike alongside the buildings my ancestors built and died in. Oblivious to my own history, here I am, traveling in these ghosts' old, rutted roots. My great-great-grandfather probably traversed Yesler Way every day, and now I do.
An excerpt from the essay Profanity Hill, A Tour of Yesler Way, which was anthologized in the book Ghosts of Seattle Past, and read by writer Rachel Kessler. So, Rachel, here we are, right in front of that cornerstone that you wrote about in the essay. Can you describe what it was like when you first encountered it and how it felt?
Yeah, I didn't grow up Jewish. I didn't really know much about that. But when I discovered this connection, I wanted to reconnect with my Jewish past. So I decided to fast for Yom Kippur. And so I was a little hungry and maybe beginning to hallucinate. But I was in an altered state. And I came here and upon seeing it, I don't know, there was something, it was a really profound moment. And I felt, you know, a physiological reaction to seeing this solid evidence of this past that I had heard about, I had been reading about. But I found myself crying and really began to understand something that I think I knew about intellectually, particularly as a white person living in the Central District in Seattle. I think a lot about my role in gentrification here and you know, in erasing the people that came before, the, you know, historic communities that made this neighborhood the neighborhood that it is, that I love so much. And then I think experiencing that, I had these roots to this place and the power of this place on me, like in a very physical way, was revelatory. To realize that places have ghosts, it just sort of furthered my passion.
How has this work affected the way that you think when you're just kind of moving through the world? Like as you go through different Seattle neighborhoods and you see maybe something that looks new, something that looks old, how does it change the way you look at everything?
Well, I mean, I've always liked living in old houses because I liked thinking about like who slept in this room before I did and what happened here and what, you know, what stories could these walls tell if they could talk? And I think about this a lot when I'm walking on Yesler. Seattle has so many hills that have been regraded, like Jackson, for instance, you know, and sluiced out into the Puget Sound. And I mean, just that the land literally has the marks of history on it. It has a story to tell. Like Yesler Way, for instance, it was carved out by a big glacier, you know, 20,000 years ago. It's like 16,000 years ago, the Puget Lobe started to recede and carved out. That's why we have these huge hills. And, you know, 12,000 years ago, yes, what we call Yesler Way now was a trail that the First Nations, the Native Americans, used to carry their canoes from the saltwater of Puget Sound, the Salish Sea, over to the freshwater of Lake Washington. So the land has stories to tell if we look at it. I mean, I guess I also walk around and realize that it's not all fully apparent, because I walked past this building a million times my whole life. I mean, I grew up in this area, and we'd go past this building, but I had no idea that my family was connected with it.
Well, Rachel Kessler is a writer based in Seattle, and she's working on an interactive community cartography project called Profanity Hill, also an audio tour in the works, and lots of other things. So thank you so much for sharing your history and your ghosts with us.
Thank you. It was fun to talk a lot.
You're tuned to Sound Effect from 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is ghosts. What if something was thought to be gone forever? Would you still go looking for it? We head to eastern Washington now, to the region known as the Palouse. That's where a man spends a lot of time searching abandoned homesteads, looking for ghost apples. It turns out some of the apples long thought to be extinct are actually still alive. More now from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing.
Going to go over here?
Yeah, we're going to go through here.
All right.
We're headed through here.
Oh, wow.
I am being led by a very tall, thick man named David Benscotter along the base of Steptoe Butte in Whitman County, Washington. He is plowing like a bull through a wall of wild, thorny roses.
Whoa.
Steptoe Butte, where we are, is a 3,600-foot tower of earth that looms over the rolling hills of the Palouse. David zeroes in on what we're looking for.
There you go. That's a nice-looking apple there. No insect damage at all. Well, I take that back. I see a little bit, but it doesn't look like it's going to affect it. So this is one that I'll taste test. It's a very good apple. It's got a lot of kind of tanginess.
Now, is this an apple that was thought to be extinct?
Yes.
It's called a Dickinson apple. It's a deep red with a white flesh. It was thought to be gone forever until David found it last year. These trees that were forgotten for 125 years are now carefully laid out on a map drawn by David. GPS coordinates are recorded. Gnarled branches are being pruned for the very first time to stimulate new growth.
And what I'll do is this winter, I'll go back to this tree and cut off these branches of new growth, and then I'll provide those to heritage apple nurseries around the country.
David is not a botanist. When he finds an unusual apple, he sends it off to be identified by a small network of apple experts. So far, David has recovered two other apples thought to be lost, the Arkansas Beauty and the Nero. David's sleuthing skills that are helping him find forgotten fruit played a role in his former life. He's a retired FBI investigator with a specialty in tax evasion. As he likes to joke, he was a tax man with a gun.
I'm just very comfortable in looking for clues and trying to, you know, piece things together.
We head deeper into the tall grasses of Steptoe Butte.
Do you ever encounter any snakes?
No.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that beautiful? A pheasant. Wow.
It was here 2 years ago where David found the ultimate lost apple mystery.
On that early fall day, I came and I actually sat in a table just as we're sitting here. And I looked at the ground and the ground was absolutely covered with apples. And I was totally perplexed because these were apples on the ground in early September.
Where I would have only seen a fragrant pile of rotting fruit, David saw evidence of a colossal failure.
Nobody who knew what they were doing would grow commercial apples 100 years ago that ripened in September.
Commercial buyers in the East wanted winter varieties of apples that would last in a cellar until spring.
It made absolutely no sense to me at all.
This failure has a name, Robert Burns. He was a homesteader. He began farming this land with his wife, Macy, in 1888, the same year that Frederick Douglass became the first African-American nominated for U.S. president. David combed through county records and tracked down distant relatives who are the keepers of old family documents and letters.
Everything I've ever read about Robert Burns is he was a super nice man. He was a family man. He was a hard worker, but he was a tiny man. He wasn't very big, and I don't think he was made to be a farmer.
Like just about every other farmer on the Palouse, Robert Burns grew wheat. But in the early fall of 1893, the rains came.
And it did not stop raining. And the farmers in this area never got their wheat crop out of the fields.
So Robert Burns diversified. He planted plums, pears, and lots of apples, more than 800 trees. But he planted the wrong varieties that wouldn't sell. And they took several years to grow.
time ran out. By 1899, he was bankrupt and sold his 160 acres. Eventually, he and his wife and their 7 kids moved out to the coast. Since then, the land has barely been touched.
Robert Burns' failure as a farmer is leading to perhaps the discovery of as many as 15 to 20 apples, lost apples, on his property. I mean, it's amazing.
What does this mean to you? Why do you think this is important?
Well, you know, these trees are just going to go away someday. And if I don't do it, there's no one who's going to search for them.
David is also doing this work because he knows it's important to an older generation, the descendants of pioneers, people like Cotton Crider from Oaksdale, Washington.
And we've come up here ever since I was old enough to walk.
And her cousin, Gail Hanford Santora.
Apples have brought our families together.
Gail and Cotton are here with David today to have him test out a fruit picker that Gail's late father invented. It's a long pole with what looks like 2 mittened hands at the very end.
It picks apples much like your hand would if you could extend your arm up into a tree and pick that fresh, juicy apple right on the top of the tree.
Cotton and Gail's great-grandfather owned a nursery on the Palouse and had acres of apple trees. They are incredibly grateful for David Benscotter's work.
It's just so interesting to think back all those years when these trees were planted and that they're still here. It's just like unlocking a secret.
What he's doing kind of melds the past with the present.
All of this came really close to going away. Last year, 450 acres of the land where the old apple trees live went up for sale at auction.
And I could just see some farmer buying up the land and coming in and taking out hundreds of apple trees, including lost varieties. To attend the auction, I think I had to put down like $5,000 or something like that to even come and observe the auction.
So you did that?
So I did that, just so I could get in the door.
That's how committed you are to this land.
Well, yeah.
It turns out that the people with the winning bid are conservationists. They want to protect the native grasses and wildflowers that were here long before the fields of wheat. David had no idea that these treasures existed, and the new owners knew nothing about the lost orchards of Robert Burns. For now, all of these rare bits of life, color, and forgotten apples waiting to be rediscovered will remain.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme today is ghosts. To say that Seattle musician Lydia Ramsey was raised in a musical family would be kind of an understatement.
Me and my brothers joke that in order to like sit down in our living room, you had to pick up an instrument because it was taking up the chair. And then you're like, oh, well, I'm holding this, so I might as well play something on it.
Eventually, Lydia would decide to dig a little deeper into her family history. What she found out is that music has been woven through her ancestry for generations. She's incorporated some of the stories she uncovered into her music, fantasizing in her lyrics about the lives they might have led. She joined us in the KNKX performance studio to play her song, Ghosts. But first she sat down with Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad to talk about sharing some of her family ghost stories through music.
I have a grandma who actually went to church revivals with 2 of her girlfriends, and they sung 3-part harmonies and provided the music for a lot of these old church revivals. And one of the things I found out was that they were sharing this message of love and inclusiveness through music, which was so cool. And
how old was she when she was doing this?
She was doing this when she was 14 years old.
Oh, wow.
Which is crazy and amazing. And there would be like 1,000 people at these church camp revivals. And then further back, like her family and my great-great-grandparents and beyond Yeah, we're based out of like the hills of Appalachia and further back in Ireland and Scotland, where so much folk music is from. And I just found it so interesting that I'm so drawn to this old, kind of old-timey sound and this old music, and was so curious where that came from. And, you know, we all have these pieces of us that make us who we are. And a lot of what that is are these stories that we don't know anything about. And that's such a fascinating idea to try and connect with and learn more about ourselves through seeking out these stories and then being able to retell them.
How did it make you feel to sort of uncover your family history and find out these interesting stories? How did that sort of hit you?
Well, I think it played a big part in me being able to think about my own music more seriously in terms of getting it out into the world and looking at it as more like, this is my purpose on this earth. This is the thing that I should be spending my time doing and sharing. And that realization helped me feel like I was more a part of this bigger musical story, and that it was important that I played my piece while I have this tiny time here on Earth.
Did you feel like you were kind of carrying on the family too? I mean, from generations ago? Is there any part of you, do you sort of, I mean, I hate to use the word channel, but do you sort of tap into that?
Oh, don't be afraid to use the word channel, Kevin. I mean, I think that there's so much more going on, you know, than we are physically around. Yeah, especially with the song Ghost specifically, I definitely felt connected to, you know, the people that came before me and my family that were writing songs.
So the song Ghosts, you're certainly incorporating some of the things that you learned about your family into that song. But I also imagine that there's probably like a certain level of imagination that gets to go into that too, where you can sort of, I mean, you weren't there to see the day to day, you know, sort of the general overarching story of your family, of your members of your family that you're incorporating in the song. But I bet you get to kind of play with it in that song a little bit, too.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I know, you know, I had, like, a great-great-grandfather who played the fiddle, but just imagined that maybe he was courting my great-great-grandmother, and she also played the fiddle, because women are amazing, too. And so I just kind of was able to play around with that a little bit with the lyrics. And, you know, there's some lyrics about a girl riding a horse around the hills, which is just, you know, like a fantasy of something beautiful that I don't know if any of my family members did that. But I mean, I can probably say that they did. So
yeah, poetic liberty. Yeah. And since you're here with your violinist, Jacob Anderson. Would you take us out with Ghosts?
We would love to. In a place I don't know, he made his bed in a house he called home. He liked walking slow in summertime.
Up in a house that she called home. She was sewing dresses long before the dust had settled on a town that I don't know. She She tossed her hair in the sunlight, riding horses up in the hills. I don't know. She was preaching from the highest steeple to an entire town she called her home. She liked talking into the middle of the night. Oh, and she wrote down a song for you and played aloud whenever you came into sight. Oh, darling, she wrote down a song for you and played aloud whenever you came into sight.
Lydia Ramsey in the KNKX Performance Studio, joined by Jacob Anderson on violin, performing her song, Ghosts. Her latest album is called Bandita, and you can catch her live November 10th at the Anchor Pub in Everett. You can also see a video of her performing this and another song at our Facebook page. She spoke with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad. That's it for today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Shane Mailing. Thanks also this week to John Kessler and to Jamie Garbacek, as well as the Seattle Department of Arts and Culture. We get multimedia help from Parker Miles Blum. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get that sort of thing. Find us on Facebook by searching KNKX Sound Effect or write us at soundeffect@knkx.org. And come on back next week when our theme is What Are the Odds? I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.
And making love brought me here today.